A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, to get 30, to get 20, 20, 20, to get 20, 20, to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Welcome to the Curzon Film Podcast. In this episode, the most important pop biopic since Katy Perry Parted Me. It's Brady Corbett's Vox Lux. Plus, we've managed to swing some time in the VIP section and talk to two of its stars, Stacey Martin and Rafi Cassidy. Hello, I'm Jake Cunningham, and joining my pod chorus this week, screaming from the balcony, it's Kelly Powell.
Hello.
Crying from the front row, it's Ella Kemp.
Hello.
And standing behind a beam because he could only afford restricted seats, Sam Howell is here too.
Hello.
Hello. All right, so we're going to be talking all about Vox Lux today, as I said, as well as talking to Rafi Cassidy and Stacey Martin. And this is the new film from the director of The Childhood of a Leader, if anyone saw that one a few years ago. But to quickly set this one up, it's 1999 and Celeste, played by Rafi Cassidy, survives a violent high school shooting. She sings at the memorial service and the clip kind of goes viral and she becomes a superstar with the help of her songwriter sister, who's Stacey Martin, and her manager, played by an excellent, slimy Jude Law. And then there's a big time jump. By 2017, adult Celeste is now played by Natalie Portman, and she's mounting a comeback after a scandalous incident that derailed her career. She's about to tour her sixth album, and the now foul-mouthed pop saviour must overcome her personal and familial struggles to navigate motherhood madness and monolithic fame. So before we jump into this film and the interview, I thought it would be a great opportunity to give a bit of background on the director and the cast that we're talking to today as well.
Sure. So first of all, the director, Brady Corbett, initially an actor. He was in Greg Araki's Mysterious Skin, Catherine Hardwicke's 13. He worked with Michael Haneke on the Funny Games remake. He was in Melancholia. And his directorial debut a few years ago, Childhood of a Leader, you can see he's influenced by the directors he worked with. It's very Haneke-esque, it's very Lars von Trier-esque, and that's carried on here in Vox Lux too.
Yeah, and that one got a lot of acclaim. It's his first film.
Yeah,
he played at Venice 2015.
One Best Director of Venice.
Mm. Yeah.
There's also some parallels to Vox Lux as well in terms of the structure and this idea of like a film of, you know, a film of two halves where you see a character's childhood and something very dramatic happens to them in that childhood, and then you see how that's affected them in adulthood and what they've become, the sort of monster they've become.
Mm. And well, he has said in past interviews that he saw this film, Vox Lux, as almost like a sequel to Childhood of a Leader. He said he, in his mind, he wrote it as a sequel, which is interesting to think about, that it's a continuation of the same sort of themes.
Yeah, are you seeing The Childhood of a Leader?
Yeah, and I think stylistically as well, there's a lot of parallels between the two films in that I think often stories where you'll start with a young person who then grows up, you can immediately think coming of age. Brady Corbett's films, they're not coming of age from like boyhood or whatever. Nothing of that. It's very, very dramatic. You've got this huge like gothic, dark atmosphere. It's very oppressive, but also very, very exciting, I think.
Yeah, what an interesting career as well. And he's done bit parts in Eden and While We're Young, Force Majeure, and it kind of seems like he hit a point after doing stuff when he was very young where he's just gone to work with people that he's interested in working with, and clearly maybe 10 years ago thought, right, I want to make my own things. And he's got credits as co-writer and editor on things and bits and pieces, and just kind of slowly, in quite like compared to when we see maybe actors kind of suddenly go and direct a film out of nowhere where you don't see any credits for them to prove that that's something they can do. It's nice to see this guy really kind of build and build and build and just kind of step into this when he feels that he's ready. And so central to this film, along with Natalie Portman's performance in the second half of this film, Vox Lux, you've got Rafi Cassidy and Stacey Martin, who's the only real through line along with Jude Law.
Yeah.
And you were lucky enough to talk to him.
I was, yeah. So Stacey Martin plays Celeste's sister in the film, Eleanor. Mm-hmm. And Stacey Martin broke out in Nymphomaniac. Also, she's also worked with Lars von Trier. And she's, rather than gone in to do bigger things, she's stayed in the kind of art house arena. She had a bit part in Ben Wheatley's High Rise. She was in Michel Hazanavicius's Redoutable. She's in Childhood of a Leader. So she's worked with Brady before. So they've got a good rapport together. And then Rafi Cassidy, again, she broke out in Tomorrowland.
So good.
And you'd expect a very young actor in Tomorrowland to go on to do some big, big franchise. But she's also, she worked with Yorgos Lanthimos in Killing of a Sacred Deer. Mm. She's also stuck in these kind of smaller, interesting films, which is really interesting for young actors to do, to not jump at the chance, to not have a Jude Law character in their life, to push them into doing these bigger, louder things that they're doing what they want to do. And that's really interesting.
Yeah. And she is really good in Tomorrowland as well.
And in Killing of a Sacred Deer, she has a little a cappella pop song moment as well.
Yeah.
So
it's great.
There you go.
Under the tree.
Yeah.
Mm. Yeah.
Iconic.
Yeah, yeah. She is really good in that. All right, cool. And yeah, so you spoke to both of them about this one.
Yeah, I did speak to them. We spoke about how Brady compares to the other auteurs they've worked with, how the film sort of was influenced by what they thought of pop stars before and after reading the script, how confident Brady is as a director, and just the whole sort of idea of young people in the entertainment industry and growing up in that industry, and how that kind of, how their experience of that compared to Celeste's experience with that. So here it is. Enjoy.
We're delighted to welcome Stacey Martin and Rafi Cassidy to the Curzon podcast. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having us. Yeah.
So we're talking about Vox Lux, of course. Can you both talk about how Brady first presented you with the idea for this film, when you first read the script, and what your initial thoughts were about this idea, this concept?
Well, I think you were on board before, way before. But when I came onto it, Stacey was already on it. I think pretty much everyone was already on it, and Brady, I had a Skype with Brady. I'd only read about a quarter of the script. And I spoke to him on Skype, and he told me all about this amazing kind of contemporary piece, which is about the history of, you know, what's happened in the last decade or so. It was a really interesting piece. And then he told me about the two characters. Mm-hmm. And yeah, I really wanted to be a part of it. So.
I read the script. Brady had sent me the script because I worked with him on his first feature, Childhood of a Leader. And he said he wrote this new script and he wanted me to read it. And there was this part in it called Eleanor, and he wanted me to play. So I was quite excited because I loved working with him. Mm. The idea of working with the same people regularly is something I'm looking to do. Mm-hmm. And so I read the script and I was so excited because it was so vast and dense and aesthetically exciting. And the fact that he already had in mind Scott Walker to do the score and Sia, and I just thought all of these elements are just going to make an amazing film. And so I just said yes immediately.
Mm. Rafi, you played two roles in the film, young Celeste and then Celeste's daughter. Can you talk about the challenges of playing two roles in the same film and how you and Brady kind of worked together to form these two separate characters?
I think that's kind of how we did it. We acted as if it was for me, it was easier to make it as if it wasn't in the same film, obviously, because a person sees, you know, things that happen in a completely different way. So it was really helpful as well because we shot it quite chronologically, don't you think? Like, in order, so I first did Celeste, and then after that we had a break, well, not a break, but like then we swapped over to the second half of the film, But I guess the general things like accent and appearance, they were the things that we played with.
Okay. So Brady's obviously an actor as well himself. Can you really get a feel from that in his approach to directing, that he's been where you guys are and he knows what you're going through and everything?
Sort of. I mean, I kind of see him as a director, even though I know him initially as an actor. For me, he's one of these incredible people that you meet and you just know they're going to keep making incredible films for the rest of their lives. He's a real cinephile, and the way he approaches not only actors but film in general is quite encompassing, and I kind of see that. I don't, when you see him as an actor, I kind of think, oh, but he's so much more.
I think the way that he, I think it was quite clear that he had had experience in acting, and with the way that he kind of delivered, you know, the way that he wanted us to do things, you could tell, because it was really easy to understand as well, and I think that was really helpful, being an actor.
So obviously a huge part of the film is, you know, a young woman's introduction to fame. Did any of what Celeste goes through mirror your own experiences of being sort of thrown into this world of fame and celebrity and the entertainment industry?
No, not at all.
Really?
No. No. No, I mean, it was when I read it out, I had no clue about this. I guess she's a pop star and it's a completely different thing where your personality is, you know, you as a person are thrown into the, whereas being an actor, you play these characters. No one actually, you know, apart from things like this, no one really sees the real you. That was really deep.
Yeah,
was
like, wow.
Did you find anything?
No, I think the only similarities that you would have is more sort of the system that exists behind behind someone like a pop star, or whether it be a music band or even actors. There is a whole organization behind, and people tend to not really see that aspect. They just think, oh, it's just really easy, but it's everything is controlled and everything is organized and thought through, and that's something that I've sort of, you kind of, we deal with it on a day-to-day basis, but in terms of the rest, I think it's quite specific to probably to music and to a certain level of fame as well, that I'm definitely not.
Kind of going on from that then, the film has loads of questions about sort of the responsibility of fame and the difference between popularity and notoriety. Are these kind of questions that you talk about amongst yourselves in this kind of, this part of the industry, in the entertainment world?
I talk about it more with my friends. I do think we're sort of veering towards a moment in time where fame is taking over talent, and there's this amazing scene with Albertine and Celeste in the diner where Celeste says it doesn't really matter if you're Michelangelo or Michelangelo from New Jersey, or I can't remember exactly what it is, but it's true. There's this something about sort of our society that craves a story and craves an angle, and it doesn't really matter if you're talented or not, as long as you can sustain that level of fame, and that's something I think we're already in it.
Yeah. Okay. So let's talk a bit about Celeste then, who's the kind of the real centerpiece of this film. I think in another film she could very easily just be this purely unlikable character, but this film she's so complicated. Can you talk about how you read Celeste before you saw the performances? Like, what kind of character did you see her as beforehand?
Well, I really enjoyed playing with Raffi and with Natalie, because you could really feel sort of the experience in life taking over when Natalie arrived. What's so great is that we don't see everything that happened within those two moments, but you understand it because her performance is so dense and so bold, and you recognize everything that she's been through by how she is. And ultimately, she's someone who is trying to constantly battle with the image of Celeste, and Celeste is who she is. But I think you must have, I mean, did you ever talk to, I'm going to do the interview now.
Sure, please.
Because I guess it's different seeing it.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Obviously playing it, I guess.
Yeah, as watching it, I didn't think, when I read it, obviously I kind of felt sympathy for her because I knew what she'd been through when she was younger. But then watching it, I felt so much more sorry for her. Mm-hmm. I don't know, because you just see this, like you say, it's like two completely separate things of who we see at the start to at the end.
Yeah.
Yeah, you just feel so sorry for her, and you can think, how can a person who is behaving so horribly you feel so sorry for? But
yeah,
you do.
And Brady's been kind of coy as to who the kind of inspiration is for the Celeste we get in that second half. I mean, there's hints of like sort of Gaga or, you know, Britney or Madonna. Did he let you in on any of the inspirations for Celeste, and did you bring any to it yourself?
I don't know if it was completely inspired by a particular person. I think he developed this character of, you know, everything that he researched and sees. So I don't think it's...
I don't think it's one person. Yeah. I think you really feel it in the film, where we recognise so many pop idols of our times, and we recognise the ones that were really sort of shattered by it and the ones who kind of survived through. I think she's a great mix when you look at Britney Spears and how hard it was for her to kind of grow up in this system. And then when you look at Madonna, they both handled it very differently. Mm-hmm. And I think Celeste represents all of these modern pop almost stereotypes that we have in our culture, that we assume they're just, oh, it's just Britney Spears, but it's also it's also a human being.
Exactly, yeah. I think with films like this, and even A Star Is Born to an extent, there's this idea of like people looking at pop music slightly differently, like looking past the fact that they're just this sort of pop diva on stage, that there's actually a lot more going on there. Have you found that yourselves after watching the film and experiencing the film?
I see it a lot more in the type of pop music that's being made today. If you look at what Sia does, and you know, her visual concept is very strong, and I think pop artists now have their own identity that is unique to them, and that's why people enjoy their music. I think with this film, I realised how everyone is responsible for making this person, Celeste. So even though we might despise the manager, we might despise Eleanor, they're all victims and they're all responsible for what they've created. And I think that's one thing I really took from the film.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I learned a lot on this. It's just a completely different world, which I didn't know went on. And I think for a lot of people watching it, they'll realise a lot of what goes on behind the scenes with musicians. But yeah, it's an amazing thing that they can have their own identity.
Yeah. And so you mentioned there this about working with Brady and about wanting to work with people over again. How does Brady's approach to directing compare with the other auteurs? Because you've both worked with like Lars von Trier, Yorgos Lanthimos. How do those kind of approaches differ?
Well, I mean, every director has their own way of working, so no one is the same. What I really enjoy with Brady is that he has a very European sensibility. His cinema feels very European. Even Vox Lux, for me, even though it's a very American film, the way he films it, the way he built his cast, feels like a very auteur filmmaker. I think he approaches directing as a whole thing, where it starts from the writing. His scripts are really beautifully written, and his dialogue is very witty and really, really well done. And that's something that you find with Lars von Trier, and I don't know, maybe Yorgos is the same, but it starts from the very base of the blueprint of the film, which is the script.
Okay. Yeah, I think what's so interesting about Brady is that he is so different from any other director. But one thing I noticed on this was that the script kind of stayed the same.
Right.
With a lot of things I've worked on, like, it changes throughout, but Brady had this, you know, precise thing. And yeah, when we film on a day, it would kind of stick to that, which on other things I've done, it hasn't really been like that too much.
Okay. Final question then. How long was Wrapped Up in your head for? Because it's not left mind.
It's still in my head. Yeah. And sometimes I get quite emotional when I hear it. I'm like, oh, that was... I mean, it feels so long ago, but it feels so close, and it's kind of it kind of followed us for quite a long, I mean, followed me for a really long time.
Yeah, because that was like one of our first scenes, wasn't it?
Yeah.
In the church.
Yeah.
Great. Stacey Martin, Rafa Casti, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
Cheers.
Thanks.
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
All right, thank you, Rafi and Stacey, for that. So, because this film is very much divided down the middle, I thought I'd divide our discussion into two sides, one and two, and then not to compare them in any way, not that we have favourites at all, but let's start with the opening. And this is the school shooting that really sets up everything. And how did we find this one? Because personally, I found like the opening five, 10 minutes of this is a grueling experience.
Oh my God, yeah, it just throws you right in there. Yeah, I remember going like, and you can feel it building. You can feel it building and you're like, oh my God, it's getting it so quickly. And then it happens and you're just like, oh, shit. And you kind of, it sets the tone for the rest of the film, really. It's kind of like, oh, okay, I'm not watching I might have thought I came to see.
And what is that tone? What is that feeling?
I mean, I would just say that it's whatever you liked and enjoyed about A Star Is Born. This is not that.
Yeah.
I do like A Star Is Born, very much so, but I love how Vox Arc is just, it just slaps you in the face from the start. Mm. And I think it's just so ambitious. And I think this is Brady Corbett coming off the back of Childhood of a Leader thinking, you liked that one? You thought that one was like hardcore? Well, look how much more we can do. And it really just, yeah, I find it very immersive. And I'm just trying to think of another film with like comparable scenes at first. And obviously the whole film is not Gus Van Sant's Elephant, but in the kind of way that it's very mobile and that camera like really eerily goes throughout the school, and you're just in this horrible traumatic moment.
It's got that inescapable spectral feeling where you have the feeling of freedom that comes with a floating camera that in some ways can be amazing, but the fact that you are trapped within this narrative just makes it even harder to watch because you feel like in some way you should be able to escape, but you just can't, and you keep pressing forwards towards this inescapable thing. It's interesting that you say it's immersive because I think it's quite an art film. It's quite heavily stylized. It's biblical, unashamedly biblical. You've got Willem Dafoe for the second time in a number of weeks doing narration over a black screen, being quite philosophical, and introducing the story in the style that one might introduce a Bible text.
Or a fable of some sort.
And it comes up with title cards that are similarly gothic and quite enlarged, that are wonderful, like the credits in this.
Credits
in the beginning. I'll go off on one on that, but I won't. But they are amazing. But for me, like that doesn't necessarily say immersion.
No, I think, yeah, it's a strange one, the way the sort of style refers to what's going on in the film, because they don't really gel together. I think that's on purpose. I think it's all about this kind of the shallowness of Celeste's life, the sort of however many years, 18 years, whatever we see in her life. And I think, in a way, the fact the film's so stylized is a reflection of, look how shiny and stylized this is, but actually everything that happens in the film is quite horrible and quite ugly.
Yeah, I think
there's an eeriness that pervades the film, I think, throughout. Yeah,
and that payoff of contrast between this of treatment of religious figures and iconography and pop stars perhaps more pays off in the second half when we see Celeste as the pop star that she is to become, whereas in the first half, that it's a lot more focused on her, on the real life or the preceding life for her. And that's where we first obviously meet Refi Cassidy and Stacey Martin. And they're both doing great work along with Jude Law. And I think it would be great to delve into those performances briefly. Mm. What do you make of Refi in this one?
She's so good. She's amazing. Yeah, I really like... So Refi Cassidy is from Manchester and obviously plays this all-American girl, really. And I think you can tell there is a very deliberate way of making her seem like a version of the characters you see there. She's slightly off-kilter the whole time. She's not completely erratic or explosive, maybe in the same way that her character might become. But she's just... Yeah, I find it so interesting the way that you can tell that she will never be able to escape that trauma that she has and that pain. And yet she's always kind of trying to be confident, and there's this like horrid narcissism, which is always tinged with anxiety at the same time. So I feel like, yeah, it's a really strange balance that I think she strikes so well in being very vulnerable, but also like aggressive and abrasive at all times.
Yeah. Whilst like both her and Portman's performance in the latter half, they're both extremely layered, they're measured works. I think in the first half, the younger Celeste has to go through significant change, and you have to track that over the 50 minutes of this first half of the film. Whereas I think Portman's side of the film, she's very much in her ways. We know what that character is. She knows what that character is, and it doesn't really change over the course. And that's down to how that second half is structured, because it's also very different to this first half. But I think the challenge, and for me, what makes Refi Cassidy's performance more interesting than Portman, is that we see her go from this kind of almost Bible Belt innocent kid playing the keyboard in her bed to having to reach a point where that transition into what Portman becomes is believable, and I think she reaches that point.
She has to be like three different characters within that one confined space, but while keeping that same kind of personality, which I think she does. Like, I think from the moments in the school, the way that she's interacting with the other student, and then later on the way she talks to people, I think you can really see the same kind of like the way that she maintains this eye contact and this strength in her, just the way she carries herself, even though like her job and talent, I guess, and everything changes, there is that same kind of resilience, which I think is really admirable.
Yeah. It's also where we meet Jude Law as the manager, who's great.
He doesn't change.
Yeah, Jude Law's hair for like maybe the last 20 years has been a big
up and
point.
Down, yeah. Back and forth.
He's never quite sure whether it's going to land, but this is the perfect role for where Jude Law's hair is right now. It's perfect. It's slick, it's slimy, it's gorgeous. I will make a note for people that want to have more Jude Law chat, the new podcast Law School by Fran Hopfner and Caroline Simmons. Is great film by film analysis of Jude Law.
Amazing.
Do check it out. But he's really good, and he is exactly that kind of late 90s pop star manager character, but doing it so well.
He's so slimy in this. I'm surprised anyone can shake his hand or any clothes and stay on him without just slipping off.
You just come off the set of The Greasy Strangler.
Yeah, it just slimes along the walls. I think Jude Law's best when he's real. A real sort of scumbag, slime ball.
Yeah. I mean, there's elements of Dickie Greenleaf from Mr. Ripley in here.
Oh, yeah.
For sure. He's excellent in this. And he goes quite big change. Like, second half of this, he's a bit more of a dad.
He's a bit more dad bod.
He's a bit dad. He's like, but he's also like a bit sad drug dad.
Sad drug dad. Which half does he wear more tracksuits?
Second half.
The second half. Oh, yeah, that's my favourite part. Yeah. He's got a little bit of a belly. Also, I love how, we'll get to this more, but I love how in the second half, everyone's accent is turned up to 11.
Oh, yeah.
Let's move on to side two. So we've shifted now.
Yeah. Well, we've mentioned that Refi Cassidy is from Manchester, and for a young actor to do an accent and also do a very good performance is really difficult. But she manages it. Her accent in the first half is really great. It's really quite subtle, I think. Is it Staten Island they're from?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's... But then... And she does it really well. And then Natalie Portman is just like...
I won't stay down.
It's this. She's making choices with her accent.
Yeah.
Wow.
You know? Oh yeah, she has picked a lane.
Well,
yeah, she's picked a lane and she's changing, and everyone's like, "Whoa, get off the road!" No one else can come up. So Jude Law's like, "Okay, I guess I gotta do it as well."
Yeah, you're right.
But he said in past interviews, Brady Corbett, that he wanted her to be like what is the Real Housewives?
Like that's like a mob wife.
It's like a mob wife.
Like a mob wife. Yeah.
No, seriously, he said that.
So but. I do love it that she turns it up to 11 and she really goes for it. And whatever happened in the years between the two halves of the film has just turned her into a fame monster. Mm. She's, I think another film would have her like be a complete unlikable antagonist, you know, because she's really quite awful in the second half, like really difficult to be around for everyone.
Well, yeah, I think the narration that comes between part one and part two is an important sort of understanding of maybe what has happened in those 20 years between, you know, when she first becomes a pop star to where she is now.
Yeah, and I think this is the Von Trier influence again on that we're seeing here, as well as having Willem Dafoe do narration over a black screen and chaptering the film. Von Trier will almost spoil the chapters of his film within the title card.
Mm.
Like within Dogville, it's like, chapter 8 in which blah 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 and then over the next 15 minutes exactly that comes
I mean the
about.
House that Jack built with the quotes as
yeah
well,
exactly and, mm. And in here it's just it's doing exposition but in a way that's quite helpful means you don't have to worry about actually what happened and we can spend an hour right up close with this character instead and the structure of the second half is really interesting. We've gone from the first half where we're covering quite a long period of time. We actually go through, we've got this quite static, drawn out, composed shots.
Do we know how
time lapse
long the first half is?
55 minutes.
No, but do we know how long, how many years it covers? So it's like 1990, and it ends at 9/11, doesn't it, pretty much?
Yeah.
So I guess like 2 years?
Yeah.
And then we jump 17 years. But then the style of this is, I would say something like Birdman would be similar in that we're leading up to a big concert and it's a collection of drawn out scenes that are all shot in a very similar. We're back into that floating style of the opening scene in the school shooting. And again, we're trapped and we can't escape. And so we've got that same feeling that, that like sickness in your gut.
Mm.
And all we're doing is following them walking down a street. And because we're in New York, we've seen that violence at the start. We've seen where the first half ended. And suddenly there's just this huge anxiety when all you're doing is following a conversation.
There's another act of violence as well that kind of kicks this second half into gear. And an act of violence. So there's this thing about the film that Brady's been talking about where this is a film that's like a reflection of the past 20 years. And so you have the school shooting, which is in the 90s, is very Columbine. And then you have 9/11 happens. And then you have a kind of a terrorist shooting incident, which again is reflective of around the time that the second half takes place. And you have the life of a pop star surrounded by the major incidents in the world.
Intertwined with, I think.
The regurgitation of kind of televisual media, particularly in the age of the internet as well, and like how terrorist groups like that would get videos out into the wider world. And so she's got all the weight of those events on her. And then it's not surprising that she's kind of channeling this into a whole new identity. Just to kind of get away from it. Then it's kind of building up to this concert. And this is the first time that we really hear the pop songs that are the hinge of the whole film for the first time in all their glory. How does this concert pay off for you?
They're so good. Sorry.
The songs are really good, but I had a very strange experience watching the last 20 minutes of the movie. And I think obviously intentionally, because the songs are written partly by Sia, which and he has said like the songs are really good. Like we wanted the songs to be really good. But at the same time, you're watching it in this strange context, having seen for the last like hour and a half, watched this madness unfold, and now you're kind of like, oh, here you go, watch this concert. And I think he's putting you in that position intentionally to be like, I don't feel good about this. Like, this is weird, and I'm going through a bunch of things while I watch this concert. So it made me feel, even though the songs were good, it just made me feel really weird watching.
He's not afraid of letting it play out.
Oh, I loved it. I thought it was so, I found it so satisfying. I think what I liked about it is I think often with films about pop stars or any kind of musicians, often you will start with the music, like, you know, Star is Born, you'll start with the music. And that's great. But then I quite liked that throughout this whole film, you build this character and you build this star identity that the whole world is in love with. And really, all we've heard is like a rickety kind of song at the memorial service. And then, yeah, and then you think, what? Why does everyone love her so much? Like, what is, and you know, she says that she's the new religion and things like that. And I'm like, really? And then I like that he really makes you work for it, and he makes you sit through all of this like traumatic, painful, all of this stuff to then be like, you wanted a show, like you wanted to see a star, here's everything she can do, and like this is why we all love her. And I was like, yeah,
but
she's
You're right, and it's really, but it's really interesting that it kind of mirrors the same sort of idea and theme that, like, I remember him talking at the Q&A after the movie that we saw at LFF, that he is very much fascinated with this culture that we're now living in, where we sit on our phones and we scroll through the news and it's like, oh, a school shooting, cool, next one, a bombing in, you know, Iraq, oh, cool, let's like move. It's like we're so desensitized to these
and
massive...
And the third one will be about a pop star.
Exactly, or whatever it is, like this intertwined life that we now live with, like being desensitized to tragedies and things happening. We're aware of things happening on the other side of the world, but we're very much comfortable in our space to go like, oh no, that doesn't involve
you
me.
You just watch everything in parallel.
And I'll watch like America's Next Top Model or like, you know, American Idol and feel okay about that. And I think that it is definitely a comment on, okay, you've watched this now, and now I'm giving you what you wanted.
I think that the style changes completely for the concert. We're suddenly so at a distance from her.
Oh, yeah.
And you're watching it and you think, did we actually know them at all? Like, suddenly this feels like a completely different person. Mm. And, like, which one was the real one?
And the songs are so good, though.
The songs are really good, but the concert is intentionally long to just let you mull over the last
the
2 hours, but in a very good way. Mm. And they are huge jams, as is Scott Walker's score, who died recently, his final score. These are those kind of big Baroque moments in between, and they're brilliant as well. Weirdly, the soundtrack is cut down the middle. Like, it's not a soundtrack that flows in the order of the film. It's just bangers, Scott Walker.
Also, a great film to rewatch, just because when you watch it the second time and you know all the bangers, singing along during the concert, oh, it's the best feeling ever.
All right, we should probably wrap up there. But before we do, any quick recommendations for fans of other films might want to check this one out?
If you liked Natalie Portman in Black Swan, kind of similar things here, but with a lot more glitter.
Some crying in dressing rooms.
Absolutely, loads of that. We love that. It's not A Star Is Born again, but you know, I think it's important to have all different sides of pop music. You know, there's been a lot of debates as to, does Brady Corbett hate pop music? Mm. For me, he definitely does not hate pop music. And I think it's interesting to see this more militant, aggressive, like abrasive side of pop music. If you love pop, you love Fox.
And so I was on holiday in America last week, and I was lucky enough to see Her Smell, the new film by Alex Ross Perry, which is also about a female pop star, but this time also in the 90s, but very different genre, but tackling very similar ideas to this one.
What an amazing title of a film.
Yeah.
Oh, makes me feel unwell.
It's so, so good. So if you've listened to this and you've already seen Vox Lux, get hype for Her Smell. All right, so that's on at the cinema. It's on Curzon Home Cinema as well.
It is.
As well. So Sam, you're our home cinema correspondent. Anything else on there that people should be checking out?
Well, you can check out Brady Corbet's first feature, Childhood of a Leader, which we've been talking about a lot. It's a really, really dark, interesting film, and it's a really nice parallel to Vox Lux. As we said earlier, it's a kind of the first part of Vox Lux in a way, thematically. And we've got other films that deal with the life of musicians, but fictional musicians. So we have Pavel Pavlikovsky's Cold War from last year. We have
Frank,
and we have Paolo Sorrentino's "This Must Be the Place," starring Sean Penn.
It's Sean Penn. Yeah.
"This Must Be the Place" is a song by the Talking Heads.
Oh my god!
So if you want to hear that voice for 2 hours, just go out with Sam. If you've got any thoughts on Vox Lux, then do let us know. Email us at podcast@curzon.com. Or tweet us at Curzon Cinemas. If it's your first time listening to the show, do subscribe. You can do so on iTunes, Spotify, Acast, wherever you get your pods. And when you're there, if you could leave us a comment or a review, that would be absolutely wonderful. And if you hadn't had enough of us, you can keep up with us all on Twitter. Sam, you're over there at
@SamHowlett_1.
Yeah, Kelly, you are
@KS_Powell.
Ella
@EFEKemp.
And I'm @JHCunningham. Thanks so much for listening. Farewell.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Late bloomers tend to have more curiosity. They tend to have more resilience.
There are stories and mythology that this country has woven around Black men.
This is the cavalry, right? These are the leaders, the hometown heroes and local leaders. And we are.
It's a survival mechanism to just be like, where are you, the police?
What if everything we've been taught is just all wrong?
What's worth more than this fear right now?
And that rising after failure is part of the glory of being a human being.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.